Okay, comments on a couple of the readings. Luke was the only non-Jew, probably. He was a Greek speaker from the upper class. His Greek is very classy. And only highly literate Greeks, which means to say highly wealthy Greeks, could understand his idiom. Luke is also famous for, he's the kind of Hollywood, the Cecil B. DeMille of the evangelists. He loves spectacle. He loves the miraculous. He loves everything that is wonderful and unusual. And so he blows up everything. I mean, once you know this stuff, you know, it doesn't shake your back teeth. You just say, well, that's who Luke was. Okay, and so when he says here that they sold everything and shared everything, well, maybe, maybe not, because even later in the book of Acts, you have this couple, this husband and wife, who sold a bunch of stuff and kept it for themselves, and so Luke was madder than heck and was totally displeased. Why? Why? It's very simple, I think. We are what we own. Our looks, our wardrobe, our bank account, our property, blah, 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 blah. That identifies me, most of us. And if we don't have purely economic terms, we have all kinds of other, my degrees. I have a PhD, and you don't. Okay. So, we take it with a grain of salt, but what religious truth is being expressed there? That in Jesus, all the personal barriers between us have been removed. And probably the most significant is the business of property. If I can't identify myself in terms of what I own, then I'm open to everybody else. It's as simple as that, and as difficult as that. Okay, now we go to John, the famous John. We don't know who John was. We know, scholars believe, and it's the evidence, it seems to me, is pretty convincing, that John was edited, some scholars believe, by as many as seven different hands. At least two or three are very clear, and this is not a scripture, of course, in the Gospel of John, so I will shut up. Take it from me. If you don't believe me, go to the sources. Okay? So, John, what do we know about John, or the Johns, or Johanna? Somebody suggested the Gospel of John was written by a lady, or edited at least by some ladies, which I find highly desirable. Okay, so John was a Jew, we know that, and therefore, as I've said several times in the past few weeks, the Jews believed, at least the Pharisaic Jews, the Sadducee Jews did not buy a resurrection, but the Pharisaic Jews around the year, turn of the century, the first century, they began to believe in heaven and hell, but they were imports from the pagans that surrounded them. So are there devils? Are there angels? Beats me. I haven't seen any. But that's neither here nor there either. But that was part of the Johannine culture. Assuming that God inspired these texts, he did not pick these people up by the hair and transport them 3,000 years later, or 2,000 years later. He took them as they were, with their own cultural baggage. Just like we have, although we don't recognize it most of the time, cultural baggage as well. An example being that business of paying Roger Ailes and that other guy, I don't like, Hannity. Isn't it Hannity?
Bill O'Reilly.
Beg your pardon. O'Reilly, thank you. Money. Because that's our basic criterion of success, I think. we talk about our kids, oh, he's very successful. Does that mean normally he's generous and kind and accepts everybody? Not a bit of it. It means he's got more in the bank than I do. That makes him a success. Well, and we take that for granted. You hear, I used to do a test with the kids. I would write the word success on the phone, on the board, asking them to close their eyes and open their eyes. And what was the first word that came into their minds? That's a little test. He's making lots of money. That's what success is. Well, that's totally contrary to the notion of success in the New Testament. To be successful is to be open to everybody, to be responsive to everybody. And that alone is success. How well do we love? Everything is to be judged by that, not by how much money we have. Okay, but back to John and his Jewishness. So John has all this stuff, which he created, I'm sure. So Thomas sticking his finger in an nail holes and his hand in the side hole. John, as a good Jew, had to have Jesus with nails in his hands and a big slit in his side. They wouldn't understand resurrection from the dead in any other way. Do we have to understand it that way, or is that a bit of cultural baggage as well? It is, for a fact. And many of us have been so deeply immersed in that we're not even aware that this is a total accretion to the gospel message. Okay, but then we get to the closer to the heart of the matter, that the risen Jesus, whoever that was, however he was, his first words, the resurrection Jesus, always the first words were, peace be with you. Read the gospel narratives about the resurrection. Peace be with you. I thought about this for many years, and I believe that this is another instance where we have kind of diluted the message of the gospel, malformed it, to put it even more starkly. What do you think of when you first think of peace? Let there be peace in my heart. Well, where does that come from? Oh, no, it's just me and God. We got this contract, so I'm going to worship God, and God's going to give me peace in my heart, and I won't be agitated, and I won't need to shrink or tranquilizers or anything. That's not the biblical notion of peace, and never was. Go back to the prophets. Go back to the earliest text in the Hebrew Bible from which we derive ourselves. So if peace is not this sense of self-satisfaction and complacency, what did the Jews, and Jesus as a good Jew, and John as a good Jew, see the meaning of peace as being? Simply the absence of warfare? Maybe. But that doesn't go far enough. Peace means a totally relational reality. Peace is not a private enterprise, in other words. Peace is a social grace whereby I am transformed into somebody who sees the naked and clothes them, sees the hungry, feeds them. Again, the Beatitudes are the keystone to this whole bit. Because remember the scene in Matthew where the Beatitudes appear in Matthew's version? That's the criterion for judgment. We're not talking about some trivial, extraneous thing. That's it, folks. That's the beginning, the middle, the end, finished. And if you do have that kind of openness with everybody, which is dangerous, as we see in the career of Jesus, but if you do have that kind of openness, that peace, which Jesus called peace, then you are blessed. Then you are a true friend of God, just as Jesus was. Jesus, who broke all kinds of cultic, dietary, social rules, talking to women. But the beloved Bishop of Rome, for the first time in my history, has exemplified by going to a jail on Holy Thursday night and washing the feet of a Muslim woman. Think about it, folks. A Jewish man never talked to a woman in public by themselves, much less touched them, washed their feet. No. A much more important, much more intimate thing. If you are open to everybody, if your heart is open to body, if you have eyes to see everybody, then we can be at peace. Because the great enemy of peace, of course, is fear. As long as you are afraid, you're not going to be at peace. I'm not going to be at peace. That's why I rarely am. I quickly add. Because I'm not open to everybody. It's very simple. And very few people I've had. But that's what I was getting at with the deformity. We've diluted into total triviality the gospel message of peace. Peace be with you. Peace is always shared. It is not a private possession. Peace is generated by the openness of my heart. And that alone accounts for peace, not the absence of Valiums in my existence, but the presence of this radical openness. See, that's new life. That's resurrected life. So it's not surprising that every time they depict Jesus as showing up in one form or another, walking through walls, eating fish sandwiches, or breaking the bread on the way to Emmaus. We'll get that next week. No, it is Christ, as Paul would say, I don't live now, but Christ lives in me. Christ lives in me. I don't live now, but Christ lives in me. The great transforming presence of this totally eccentric Jewish man, who made enemies of everybody, the Romans who killed him, his fellow Jews who ran away from him or betrayed him, who were paralyzed by fear, so that they could not even acknowledge him. Think of Peter at the last, at the trial of Jesus. That's new life, folks. That's new life. And all this other stuff is more or less consequential. More or less consequential. That's why Jesus got killed. Who wants to have a friend who's buddying up with everybody? The slums, the prisoners, the disabled, the ugly, the malformed. Small anecdote. That was one of the blessings of adopting a handicapped child. I was able to see the way he was treated, not just in Zambia, but here in London, Ontario, where his handicap and his color disqualified him from any real friendship. It was great to live with that. The message was borne in on me every day. But it simply was a grace because it illuminated what really separates us from each other. They were afraid of Nandwe. I remember visiting Joe Matrone, whom some of you may know, when he had a little kid, not the one who drowned, but the other one, the baby. And as soon as he saw Nandwe show up with his crutches and his stunted gait, he ran away. He was terrified. This poor little bugger. He was 2 years old, however. And many of us have not acquired a sensitivity a great deal beyond that. But we're talking about the resurrection here. We're talking about real new life, a new creation, as Paul will continuously say, who describes Jesus in his favorite terms as the new Adam. Not the Adam who lied and betrayed Eve and God, but the new Adam. So that we can, first of all, embed that vision in our hearts and in our minds. That's what we're supposed to be doing here by this exercise today. If we can do that, then we're well on the way to fulfilling all those ridiculous demands that the Beatitudes lay on us.